Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening. My next guest is Lindsay Deacon. Lindsay is the co-author of the Ed Coach Survival Guide, a coaching invisible learning consultant at Corwin Press, and a school improvement coach at Portland Public Schools. Currently, she is working as a sixth grade teacher. She has worked under Dr. Knight's leadership on his instructional coaching team and on Professor John Hattie's visible learning team at Corwin Press. Outside of her professional work, Lindsay's greatest passions are exercising and rereading A Game of Thrones. She also impersonates flight attendants from time to time. I'd like to see that for a little bit on the podcast, maybe as we wrap up. So welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast, Lindsay.
Thank you so much. I forgot that was part of my bio.
Well, those are always nifty tidbits to know. So tell me about a time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out.
Yeah, so we were talking, and I've been in the trenches, out of the trenches, in the trenches, out of the trenches. And so I have just recently returned back to the trenches after working for the district office running an instructional coaching program. And I am back in as a sixth grade teacher this year, which was relatively last minute. But as the summer was, you know, like we were starting to realize we were going to be distance learning, at least for a portion of this year, I started having this real, you know, FOMO, fear of missing out, of all the learning and just the experience that everyone in the trenches of schools were going to be happening. So I threw my name in the ring to be a sixth grade teacher, which I've taught sixth grade before, but I just felt that my credibility as a coach or any kind of school leader in the future really kind of hinges on me knowing what it feels like this year in this moment. And in a way, if I wasn't experiencing with everyone, that I would be left behind somehow. And so I'm really back distance learning with like my own sixth graders, my own new middle school team. And that's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah, you said, you know, as a result of a lot of budget cuts sometimes, and being a district coach, you know, is often that kind of title funded position or grant funded position. So, you know, sometimes if you've had really no choice but to go back into the classroom throughout your career. But I think it's, you know, a good opportunity to be there and find out what's going on, right, as you continue to serve teachers in that coaching capacity. And,
I was going to say, coaches, in my mind, we need to be rotating. Mm-hmm. I realize that maybe principals can't go back to the classroom. They might be able to teach here and there, but their job is so enormous that they really can't do both. But as a coach, I really think the opportunity to rotate or do a residency here or there, because I was a teacher and then I was a coach and then I was a teacher and then I was a coach. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there were times when it wasn't my choice where the position was cut and I was somewhat forced back into the classroom. And that was a bit frustrating at the time, but I became a phenomenally different teacher based on my experience as a coach. And then after teaching again, then I became a different coach, you know? So I think that it's just always really good for us to find new experiences so that we can evolve as professionals.
Mm-hmm. And do you think when you go back into full-time coaching after teaching for a period of time, do you take a different approach than you previously had taken?
Yeah. So I think the first thing that I noticed after coaching and then going back to the classroom the first time was I stopped thinking of myself as a teacher and thought of myself as a student coach, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. My language with students was a little bit different. Just my approach was different than it had been before. I think it was a lot less directive because I had learned so much language from being a coach. But then going back to coaching after that sort of experience, I just felt that I remembered very deeply and viscerally the toll that teachers experience every day. Mm-hmm. Just the amount of the cognitive load, all that busy work, all the thinking that we have to do, and just like the constant interruptions all day that teachers have. And I think especially having worked at the district office, we forget that, you know, and as much as they can say that they feel like they really know what it feels like to be in the trenches, it's really easy to forget just the amount of things educators are responsible for. And I think right now during distance learning, that has got to be really true. It's not to say working for the district office is easy, because it's not. It's a very heavy burden in a different way. But I think it just really builds empathy across the board when we are changing our role and thinking about how different parts of the organization function.
Yeah, that's so important to remember. And I kind of wanted to lead into the conversation about that fear of missing out, because you talked a little bit about how, you know, you were trying to coach teachers in the spring when they started the school shutdown, and, you know, you weren't doing the teaching yourself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how was that experience coaching at, you know, with the district position?
Yeah.
And kind of what made you want to reapply then for a teaching position? And what did you want to experience during this time that you felt like, you know, you needed to be a better coach?
Yeah. Yeah. I think in the spring, what really got to me deeply was that I'm somebody who likes to roll up my sleeves and just like get in there, you know, like I'm not going to say that I rushed to rescue, but it's more that I just want to experience, and I want everyone to know that I'm a team player. And so being a coach at the district level was very different, because suddenly I had no community at all. You know, we're not even seeing each other, you know, in passing at places, and I couldn't go into schools and pop in and say hello to students or to staff members. And I couldn't bring a coffee or a treat or make anybody's day just a little bit brighter in a way. And so I started to just try to lead student lunch bunch groups just to connect with students, but I definitely felt adrift myself. And I felt that what teachers were going through was did they need coaching? And the more that the spring passed and the more the summer passed, and I'm working with the coaches that I was coaching, they were saying that teachers were hungry for professional development. They wanted new information. You know, they want solutions to what's happening. And I felt in this way that how I just really couldn't even offer a whole lot of advice other than, you know, I can help them walk through or be a thought partner. But I'm usually the kind of person who gathers resources and can provide the right resource at the right time or the right moment, the right situation. And I was feeling like I didn't have that. So, you know, just thinking about being part of a community for my own personal selfishness, I just really wanted to get back and work with teachers and students and families and just like be a part of what we're doing right now.
And how is it going working in Portland right now? I take it maybe you had planned for some type of a hybrid environment, but now there's the fire. So kind of what are the plans, and how is it going teaching sixth graders virtually?
Yeah, I think in the summer I attended a conference where Peter DeWitt was a keynote. And I remember that he talked a lot about how this is not distance learning, this is pandemic learning. Yeah. And he said, because distance learning assumes that there's not a pandemic out there happening. Yeah. And that really resonated with me. I thought to myself, well, yeah, because in a traditional distance learning setting, you might assume that students can gather with each other outside of the, you know, of the school day, or that they're not isolated from each other, or that they're not experiencing like this stress of what's happening out there in the world. So, of course, the way that we kicked off the school year this year was already a bit wild, with it just being like last minute, okay, we're going to be 100% distance learning, at least for the first quarter. And then the state of Oregon was hit with the largest disaster we've ever had in our history, which was like half the state was on fire. Even we had teachers in my building who were evacuating, students whose families are crashing with them while they're attempting to log on to class. And it just really, on one hand, just the pressure of not even being able to go outside for 2 weeks because the air quality was so bad. it's just so monumentally stressful, but at the same time, I never heard the students complain at all. They were just in a way like happy to have something to do. And we were all so new to each other that I think now that, that things have gotten a bit better in the last week or so, that it's almost a, you know, people pull together during emergencies, right? And I think our school community and our school district especially has really pulled together in that way. Mm-hmm. Distance learning is pretty weird though, I guess. Yeah. You know?
What would you advise teachers who are having difficulty getting students to be engaged, especially at that elementary level or early middle school?
Mm-hmm. So I was joking that I feel like I might have to be a TV personality, like lights, camera, action, I'm on, you know? And I think that, you know, granted, I have middle schoolers, so it is a bit different than say, and I do have one group of eighth graders. And I've noticed that even the difference between sixth graders and eighth graders is the sixth graders, they're pretty chatty for the most part. And the eighth graders, not a peep. And I've heard that a lot from the high school teachers. And then the early elementary, they're like, you know, the kids are talking all the time. So I think what student engagement looks like is still, it's still such a good conversation for us to have. Mm-hmm. Because if they're logging on, okay, they're there, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're engaged in deep learning. And what I found just for myself and talking with my colleagues is that we really have to be this like very, we have to like present ourselves so much more across a screen or digitally. And I think that, you know, sometimes those corny jokes or singing songs, all the things that we do in person, but they are so much more important right now. And I have to say that early on in my career, when I was coaching, I was working with a first grade teacher, and she was a veteran teacher. And she had once told me that her goal was that at the end of the school day, that her first graders would leave the classroom super excited to come back the next day. Like that was really her bottom line, is like, they gotta wanna come back. Mm-hmm. And I always remember that. And I think for me, especially now, that is something that is rolling through my mind. Like I have to make sure that each one of these kids is really invested in coming back the next morning. Mm-hmm. Otherwise I've lost them, because it's really easy to not log on. It's really easy to disengage right now, or to come up with excuses why you don't want to show up. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like even this morning, I was like, if you're there right on time, like I have a hilarious video I'm going to show. Yeah. So it's like, we got to keep them guessing, like give them cliffhangers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like if you come on time, you know, you'll see this, right? Or there'll be that, you know, you'll roll a dice, or you'll draw straws or whatever. There's some type of a prize, right, waiting for them. So,
but you know what? I think the other thing too, though, is that, you know, I see a lot of my colleagues where, I mean, everybody's coming up with these great ideas. Everybody is so creative, and I'm so impressed with the acceleration of learning that teachers have done right now. And on the other hand, I think it's really important to say that, you know, at a specific time, you close your laptop and you accept that tolerance of ambiguity and say there's only so much I can do. You don't have to stay up till 11 at night. You don't have to text everyone constantly. Like that is not the best way to say that we're gonna reach kids. We have to be realistic in what we can do. You know, and I still mentor some new teachers, and they're staying up till midnight, and I do not know how to impress upon them that they need to just, like I was, you know, one of your previous podcasts with Amber Harper about the burned in teacher, that just resonated with me so much, because right now I know so many teachers who are burning themselves out, and it's so early in the year. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to enjoy this process as much as possible and just accept there's only so much we can do.
Yeah. And I think a lot of teachers didn't take that break in the summer because a lot of them were on edge waiting to see what would happen. And you know, I attended some, you know, webinars as well in professional development, and I taught a little bit online over the summer, but I agree that you have to be vigilant in taking those breaks and, you know, taking time for yourself and knowing that, you know, you're going to make mistakes or things aren't going to be perfect. And I think kids understand And then, you know, there's that piece also of, I think the connections are so much more important now with the students and taking the time to have those like conversations about what kids are doing and how they're, you know, what, how their day went or, you know, what they did since last time you saw them in the meeting. And what are some ways that you're using to connect your students since you've only been virtual so far?
Ooh, well, that's a good question. You know, I don't know where I found it. I found this really beautiful graphic of an ocean. Mm-hmm. It's like a painting of like five levels of an ocean. At the top, it says surfing the waves. And then the next one is like floating and then caught in a riptide and underwater. And I don't even know where I found that. It was like on the first day of school, I probably saw it on Twitter. And I thought, what a nice, pretty visual way to just check in with kids. Uh-huh. So every morning when they start, that is on the screen. And I ask them to just put in the chat, you know, like, where are you feeling? And then I ask for a few volunteers. Why'd you pick surfing the waves? Why did you pick, you know, underwater, if you're comfortable sharing it? And what I've noticed is that, you know, within the first 5 days, they didn't even necessarily need to see the graphic. Like, as soon as they show up, they're dropping what they're feeling in the chat. And I have some students, because I have them multiple times a day, mm-hmm. you know, maybe after lunch, they come back and they say, you know, I was underwater, but now I'm floating. And yeah. they want to explain that. And I think that has been such a simple tool to facilitate a really good conversation about just setting intentions and making meaningful, you know, connections in our time together.
Yeah.
You know, also, I realize as somebody who's very passionate about content that there are, in a way, more important things to do right now, and that is to help kids connect with each other and not be lonely and feel that they're efficacious in their ability to do a lot of things at home alone. The same with me. So I always ask them to give me feedback all day long, mm-hmm. you know, and that's true when I was coaching as well, that I really need to know what's working and what's not working and just give it to me straight. Mm-hmm. No feelings are hurt.
Yeah. Well, are they good at giving you feedback?
Oh yeah.
They're not afraid at that age.
No, I mean, yeah. And I, you know, I use a lot of tools like, you know, in PD, whether with students or with adults, you know, like Mentimeter or anything where I can get an anonymous quick vote on, you know, like engagement levels, boredom levels, you know, and I think that those really help facilitate that the students know that their voice also matters and where we're going.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the work that you're still doing through the coaching, you know, you're working as a PD facilitator as well. And you talked to me a little bit in the pre-chat about monthly, maybe on-site PD a little bit, and mm-hmm. How you would support teachers when you're back in the building, what you want to be mindful of as well when you're doing that PD.
Yeah, so I also, I'm the kind of person who always has like 4 or 5 jobs. But I also work for Corwin on the side, which was originally under Jim Knight and the Instructional Leadership Group, or I'm sorry, Instructional Coaching Group. And then I also got looped in with John Hattie's Visible Learning because I was just so interested in that. So while I was with the district and working for Corwin, just thinking about what are the professional learning needs that teachers and coaches actually need. There's so much, right? There's so much. But I think that what I have done traditionally was I set up an instructional coaching program here in Portland Public Schools because I was so lucky to be linked to Jim Knight early on in my career. They sent me out to Kansas, Lawrence, Kansas, and his work spoke to me just so deeply right from the first hour I remember, because he just really treats teachers and educators as humans, realistic human beings. And I think he just really gets it. And his work has just always made a really big difference to me, whether coaching or in the classroom. And so when Portland seemed to not be super invested in instructional coaching, to be honest, I wouldn't let it go. I was emailing anyone I could. I was, you know, bringing it up in conversation as much as possible. Like, we need a coaching program, and we need not just coaches in buildings, but we need somebody who's going to coach the coaches, because you can't just hand them this position and expect that they know what to do. Right. And as well as schools are messy, and there are a lot of principals who don't exactly know what coaches should be doing. So I was really lucky to work with two other colleagues to bring together an instructional coaching program that served our district, where we provided monthly on-site PD, you know, before COVID. And we would bring the coaches together, and we'd do learning once a month. But then we would also be deployed to provide on-site coaching to the coaches one-on-one and help them unpack problems of practice, or, you know, maybe walk through something that they were going to lead themselves and provide feedback on their professional development. So after that, I mean, that's a big reason that I felt comfortable going back to the classroom, was after several years of really building this program from the ground up and having, you know, a great boss who gave us the autonomy to just like take it where we felt it should go. Coaches now in Portland are pretty prolific in schools, and we're able to really show that they've had a lot of positive impact on school culture and on student achievement in some of our Title I schools specifically. So now they are off and running, and I felt like, okay, now I can go back to the classroom a little bit. So yeah, that's, I mean, I feel really lucky to have just had the opportunity to share my voice in what coaching could be, and just have the support of Jim Knight as well to allow us to do that.
Tell me a little bit about how you got involved with working with Corwin, and the story that you shared in the pre-chat about reaching out to Jim Knight, and it was kind of a fluke, and how you kind of were brought into that training.
You know, I was thinking, I'm not even sure Jim knows this story.
We'll have to listen to this podcast. Yeah.
I'm not sure, but so it was a while ago. I was a little frustrated, a lot frustrated with the district, you know, for not investing in coaching, and knowing that when I was a new teacher and I had a coach, how impactful that was on my practice as well. And then they cut all the coaches, you know, and I was so frustrated. And I really didn't feel like there were a lot of leadership opportunities in general. And I had gone back to the classroom. My students, I think they were in, you know, they were off in Spanish or in an elective. And I was alone in my classroom just feeling like, man, I want to do more with coaching, and it's not happening here. And, you know, I had my wall of Jim Knight books behind me. And I just said, you know what, I'm going to email this guy. I hope he remembers me. And so I just shot him an email, you know, that afternoon. And I just said, hey, you know, your work just, it just speaks to me, and it inspires me every day, and I use it in the classroom. And so if you're ever looking for, you know, an assistant, a coffee maker, a somebody, like whatever it is, I would love to be considered. And then it just must have been the right reach out at the right moment, because he had responded that for the first time, he was going to put together a team via Corwin, and he asked me to apply. And so I applied and I got selected. And I think I told you that when they first brought us all together, I mean, it was a whirlwind process. It was like 2 weeks later, be in San Diego, and let's talk about what this week looks like. And I got there at this beautiful resort, and I'm like, I can't even believe that they picked me, but awesome. And I felt like, you know, there's that term, the small fish in the big pond. Well, I was not even the small fish. I felt like the plankton in the ocean, because I was sitting at the table with some of the most amazing mentors and published authors and researchers out there. You know, I was like next to Ann Hoffman and Peter DeWitt. And I think Ainsley Rose was there, and Kara Vandis. I mean, there were just so many amazing people. Jenny Donahue, that I got to be not just colleagues with, but friends with. So that's how it happened. Take a risk.
Yeah.
Email your person.
Yeah. Like, those opportunities kind of fell into your lap just by taking that risk to send out that email. And, you know, that you were able to get trained and work together with those teams. And now you're in the process of publishing your book. So did that just, it came out just the last couple of months, the EduCoach Survival Guide?
Yeah, just got published late July. Yeah. Okay.
So walk me a little bit through why you chose to write a book and how you, what the publishing process and the writing process was like.
Yeah, you know, I never, ever, ever thought I would write a book because it looked like a lot of work. But there was a day when I was, you know, I was coaching coaches and I had gone from school to school to school, just from one coach to the next coach to the next coach. And I felt that every single coach had the same issue that day. And it wasn't that complicated. I thought, you know, we all have all this training and we have all these texts, these really great texts, Elena Aguilar, Jim Knight, you know, Joellen Killian, all on our shelves. And we've done this training, but a lot of them just don't really address what do you do when you're in a dysfunctional building that's got a toxic school culture and the principal doesn't know what you're supposed to be doing. And there might not even be time for coaching. And I thought there's got to be a survival guide. So I was Googling, you know, coach survival guide, and I couldn't find anything. And I just on a whim texted one of my great colleagues who's also a coach. And I said, hey, do you want to write a book? I have this idea. You know, what if we just had like 50 most common coaching issues and then just had like plan A, plan B, plan C. And in the moment, it was like a reference text. You could just open it. And she said, yeah, sure. You know, she also had no idea what went into publishing a book. And it's funny because you'd think I would know working for Corwin who publishes books, but I really didn't know. So anyway, yeah, we started the process and we were so lucky to have Jim Knight support and he wrote the foreword for us. And so it came out in July. Essentially, it really is just a reference guide for coaches who already have, a knowledge and formal training in coaching. So our book would not be the shortcut. That's not what we want. We want it to be a complement so that when things are going well, you're reading their books. And when you're stuck and things are not going well, and maybe you need to hit a panic button or an escape hatch, you pick up our book and can really just look quickly through the table of contents, you know, oh, coaches assigned to fix teachers, go to this page, or principal doesn't understand the role of a coach, go to this page, or teams aren't getting along together, go to this page. So that is really how we came about. And it's funny because we even text each other during the day and I'll say, oh, you know, I used the book today. It's been a reference guide for ourselves.
And maybe a lot of those maybe tips were built out of, did you do any type of journaling during like the years that you were coaching?
Yeah.
And then kind of reflecting back on those stories of those times and how you dealt with the situations. So was it all from memory or was it kind of looking back in your notes?
Yeah, it was definitely going back through our notes for years and also thinking about coaches that we've seen be really creative about their problem solving. So they're not just strategies that we came up with. It's really a collection of lived experiences that we've seen out there in the field. And each scenario pretty much starts with like a quick vignette. Usually they're a time that I did something wrong and had to go back and fix it. But we really feel that there are some really amazing strategies that coaches are applying in these situations because schools, no matter how much they say they support coaching, it's that, you know, it's that principals don't really quite understand the role of the coach. Teachers definitely don't understand the role of the coach. And I think that district leaders generally, they say they do, or maybe they were a coach 10 years ago, but that's not what it looks like today. And man, that is so true right now, because we also did not expect to be publishing a book during a worldwide pandemic. So we went through our book and really thought about what could be applied in a distance learning situation or environment. And so we felt that most of the things that we had provided, most of the tools, resources, suggestions could be applied via distance. So we just gave them a little stamp, you know, like this one. And now we're really finding out whether it's, you know, we have lots of coaches right now who are using the book as their own field guide and providing feedback. So I think overall, we just want to acknowledge that coaching can be one of the best jobs out there in the world. I think it can be so rewarding to really see at the end of the year the growth a teacher can make and the impact that a coach has on a school or a school system. But we also know that it can sometimes feel like the worst job because everybody comes to you to complain and they expect you to wave a wand and it's not like that.
Yeah. You know, and I think that's definitely something that's needed now is that some type of a field guide, right? It's those lived experiences, you know, being able to just look, and do you have some sort of a glossary? Like you said, people can look up what to do in a certain type of situation. And, you know, I get that how a lot of times coaches are kind of in the middle, right? You're kind of privy to information that maybe be the only the admin knows, but then you have the teachers that are like wondering why certain things are being decided on. And, you know, you're stuck in the middle. And yeah, so I think having those teachers use that and then having that mark of like, okay, this works with distance learning is a great tool to have now as we navigate these uncharted waters, right? So it's been a pleasure talking to you on the podcast today. Out of everything we talked about, what's one thing in particular you'd like listeners to remember?
Oh, you got it. You can do it. No, I really, I think that, you know, I recently did like a core values activity with coaches and with teachers. And I realized that one of my core values is risk taking. Mm-hmm. But I really think that right now is a time to experiment. And right now, I mean, really, this is such an important time in education and just in our lives in general. So I think whatever it is, get out there and take a risk. You know, just try it, whatever, you know, whether it's emailing your gym night or it's trying something that you've never thought about in the classroom or as a coach. I mean, like you're never going to get that payoff unless you just try.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, those are great thoughts to end with because, you know, everybody's trying something new, but if you don't go out there and, you know, take that risk, then you never know how it'll work out.
Yeah.
Well, where can people find you online?
Yeah. So I'm pretty active on Twitter. And we also have one for the book. So you can find me at TheRealLindsay2 on Twitter, or we also have an Instagram, which is the EduCoach Survival Guide.
Sounds great. I'll put those in the show notes as well. Well, thank you so much for being on the Out of the Trenches podcast. It was a pleasure talking to you today. And did you want to do any of your impersonations of the flight attendant?
Oh, can I tell you the quick story? You can cut it later if you don't want to. I'll tell you that what happened was once I was in Texas doing a workshop, I think it was on Jim Knight's work, and I was with several of the other Corwin authors, and we were all staying in a hotel together. And I had been there on the first night on my own, and the server had come over and she looked at me and she said, "Are you a flight attendant? Are you with Delta?" And I thought she meant, did I just fly Delta? Like, do I use frequent flyer miles? And I said, "Oh yeah." And she goes, "Great." And she whisked my my check away and came back and it was 50% off. And I went, "Oh." So I got the flight crew discount. So the next night I'm having dinner with everybody and she came over and she just looked at the table and she goes, "Oh, the whole crew's here tonight." And she took ours back and gave us all 50% off. We got the Delta flight crew discount, and all the other women at the table looked at me and I just went, just roll with it. So we all look like flight attendants tonight. So when I was writing the bio for my book, I asked a lot of people, you know, like, how do you write a bio? And Jenny Donahue, who does a lot of work with Corwin, you know, on collective efficacy, she said, "Well, you got to include that you impersonate flight attendants from time to time in your bio." So it's there for Jenny.
Well, that's an easy way to get a 50% off of a dinner.
So. I know. We must have had a look.
Yeah.